box. Love, betrayal, and damnation on a grand scale, Monday evenings starting at 7 p.m. here on KGNU.
On the latest episode of the Regional Roundup, ski-joring in the Rocky Mountain West.
Why don't we just hook up some horses to some skiers and let's have a drag race.
How communities are grappling with the recent uptick of new immigrants, writing about the climate crisis and wildfire, and a community remembers 10 lives lost in a mass shooting 3 years ago.
We will always remember how beautiful it was when we all were together.
That's the Regional Roundup from Rocky Mountain Community Radio.
Monday afternoons at 3:30 on KGNU.
Both those programs coming up later today on listener-supported KGNU, where it's coming up on 1 minute after 8 o'clock, time for an international news update from the BBC.
Hello, I'm David Harper with the BBC News. Palestinian medics say they are retrieving dozens of bodies from the ruins of Gaza's biggest hospital, Al-Shifa, after Israeli forces pulled out at the end of an intense two-week operation. The Israeli military says it killed and detained hundreds of gunmen. Yolande Nell reports.
Footage shows piles of rubble and burnt-out buildings where Gaza's largest hospital once stood, with Palestinian bodies left lying in the dirt. Hundreds of locals have returned to check on the damage to surrounding neighbourhoods, with large areas razed in the fierce battles between Israel and Palestinian gunmen. The Israeli military says it seized senior Hamas figures, as well as weapons and intelligence documents, in its surprise raid at the hospital, the second of the war. While it sees this operation as having dealt a major blow to its enemy, some Israeli commentators said it was also a worrying sign of the ability of Hamas to regroup in places that had previously been conquered, and underscored the need for a convincing post-war strategy.
The Kremlin has dismissed a media report that links a Russian intelligence unit to Havana syndrome, a mystery illness which has affected US diplomats. An investigation by The Insider, Der Spiegel and CBS alleges that the Americans were targeted with directed energy weapons. Here's Rachel Wright.
US officials suggested that those affected could have been hit by microwaves from hidden devices, but they said it was unlikely a foreign power was to blame. Now evidence has emerged suggesting that operatives from a Russian military intelligence unit may have targeted the brains of US diplomats with directed energy weapons. The report said the evidence placed members of the unit in cities around the world at times when American personnel reported feeling unwell. But the Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the accusation were baseless and unfounded.
A court in Russia has extended the pre-trial detention of a Russian-American journalist by another 2 months. Alsu Kormasheva worked for Radio Free Europe in Prague. Steve Rosenberg has more detail.
Alsu Kormasheva holds both American and Russian citizenships. Last year, on a trip to Russia to visit her ailing mother, the authorities confiscated her passports. She was fined for not reporting her American citizenship, and then, a few months later, arrested. She was charged with failing to self-register as a foreign agent. Alsu Kormasheva's employer, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, has accused the Russian authorities of conducting a deplorable criminal campaign against her simply because she is an American journalist.
Russian officials say four men they detained on Sunday were involved in funding last month's deadly attack on a Moscow concert hall. The suspects, who the authorities describe as foreign nationals, were arrested in the southern region of Dagestan on suspicion of terrorist offences. The Russian security service said one of them had confessed to handing weapons to the gunmen. World News from the BBC. A Pakistani court has suspended a 14-year jail sentence handed to the former Prime Minister Imran Khan and his wife Bushra Bibi for corruption. Mr. Khan, who's been in prison since August, won't be released because he still faces other convictions. The corruption case relates to the selling of state gifts when he was in power. It was filed against the couple in January, weeks before the general election. Pakistani officials have made at least 12 arrests in connection with a car bombing last week that killed six people, including five Chinese engineers. The authorities said among those detained was the main facilitator of the attack. Anbarasan Etirajan reports.
The Chinese engineers and their Pakistani driver were returning from Islamabad to a hydropower project when an explosives-laden vehicle rammed into their van. A Chinese company is involved in the construction of the dam in Dasu. It's not clear who carried out the attack, but officials suspect the Pakistani Taliban could be to blame. The Chinese firm has suspended all construction work in three hydropower projects in the region. Beijing has also demanded adequate security for about 1,200 of its workers involved in the projects.
The minimum wage for fast food workers in the U.S. state of California is set to rise to $20 an hour as a new law comes into force. The average increase of 25% will affect around 500,000 employees at some of the biggest restaurant chains, including McDonald's, Pizza Hut, KFC, Subway and Starbucks. Some business owners say the rise in labor costs will affect profit margins and force them to increase menu prices. The Indian Weather Office says the country is likely to experience more heat wave days than normal between April and June. A senior official said the maximum temperature was also likely to remain above normal. Last year, temperatures in several parts of the country crossed 40 Celsius. The warning comes as India prepares for a six-week-long general election starting in mid-April. And that's the latest BBC News.
BBC News, beginning the morning magazine here at KGNU for Monday, April 1st. Good morning, I'm Sam Fuqua. Coming up, community newspapers in Colorado have reason to celebrate. We'll tell you why. Also, we'll visit with a local author to talk about her new book on how to reduce stress in our lives. Checking in with the BBC again at 8:30 and commentary from Jim Hightower. Then on A Public Affair today, Jackie Sedley continues her series on eating disorders. At 9 o'clock Mondays, it's Counterspin from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, the National Media Watch Group. And our day of diverse music begins at 9:30 with the Morning Sound Alternative. All still ahead, all made possible by the listener members of KGNU. Thank you, members. And again, one more quick reminder, if you didn't get around to contributing during our spring fundraiser, we still need you, and you can go to kgnu.org, click the donate button, and be part of independent community media here on the Front Range of Colorado. Our doors are open here at 4700 Walnut, Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. If you'd like to make your contribution in person, pick out a thank you gift. We'd love to see you here. Whatever works for you in person or online, thank you for being part of KGNU. State and local headlines now. For that, here's Franzi Stangl.
The Boulder City Council will hold its biannual retreat this week on Wednesday and Thursday. In the meetings, council members will plan how to tackle Boulder's biggest issues over the next year. According to the Denver Post, the agenda includes points on the city staff's work plan for the year, as well as the city's broader strategic goals for the next few years. Every council member can make a list of priority items they want to address on Wednesday, along with visions for the city and strategies to improve decision-making. On Thursday, the council will focus on team improvement, like how to communicate with each other effectively. They will also keep working on the list of the members' priorities, together with facilitator Heather Bergman. Deputy City Manager Chris Meshuk says the goal is to have 10 priorities that they can all focus on. The Denver City Council will be discussing today whether they should accept a $2 million grant from Colorado's Transformational Homelessness Response Program. The money would go towards rapid rehousing efforts until September 30, 2026. This means they will track when people exit temporary shelters and help them transition into permanent housing. According to the Denver Gazette, Colorado has distributed $86 million for the program across the state. Legislators are going to discuss a bill today which gives trans and non-binary people more legal protection. As the law stands now, it does not include gender identity when considering bias-motivated crimes. The new bill would add gender identity and expression as a protected status. This adds to traits including race, color, religion, ancestry, national origin, physical or mental disability, and sexual orientation. Advocates want to send a message about Colorado's values with the bill, while also protecting non-binary and trans people more explicitly against the wave of anti-trans rhetoric and legislation they're facing across the country. Lawmakers will discuss a bill today that would put an excise tax of 11% on any sale of a firearm firearm precursor part or ammunition in Colorado. The bill would require every firearms dealer, manufacturer, and ammunition vendor in the state to file and return the due tax on a monthly basis. Any sales to police officers are exempt from the tax. The bill would require the state to spend that collected tax money on crime victim support services, gun violence prevention, safe and lawful gun use, and enhancement of school safety. The Senate Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee rejected a bill to stop new oil and gas drillings across Colorado on Thursday. This bill would have put the new oil and gas drilling ban into effect starting 2030. Colorado state lawmakers rejected the ban after 9 hours of public comment. Kevin Priola, one of the sponsors, describes the bill as a necessary measure to transition to cleaner energy as the Front Range continues to struggle with reducing ozone pollution and contributing to climate change. Most of the supporters were environmental and grassroots group and some public officials. Even after amending the bill, lawmakers postponed the vote indefinitely for 5-2. Beginning today, anyone living in Colorado is eligible for a $450 discount on the purchase of a new e-bike. Governor Jared Polis announced a new statewide e-bike tax credit program last week. It is part of 2023 legislation to advance decarbonization. The new program is the most ambitious e-bike tax credit program in the United States, according to Denver Gazette, allowing Coloradans to get $450 discount at the point of sale when buying an e-bike from a participating retailer. Nine News says there are no income requirements or restrictions. The Colorado Energy Office website lists 6 participating Boulder County bike shops and 5 in Denver. Denver will start sweeping its streets tomorrow to keep the air and water in the city clean. According to Denver 7, sweeping prevents sewers from getting clogged and streets from being flooded. Residents will have to keep an eye out for parking restrictions, and those who don't move their vehicle in time may get a $50 fine. The Denver Department of Transportation and Infrastructure is also asking Denverites not to sweep leaves onto the streets. Residents who want to know when it's their street's turn can sign up for reminders on the Denver City website. In today's weather, we will see a mix of rain and snow accumulating up to 4 inches in some places. In Boulder, rainy and up to 43 degrees. In Denver and Fort Collins, up to 45. In Netherlands, possible 5 inches of snow and up to 37 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Franzi Stangl.
Minutes after 8 at listener-supported KGNU. The publisher of 24 community newspapers in Colorado is getting a new printing press. That's a big deal for the nonprofit Colorado Community Media, or CCM, and for the communities they serve. We spoke with CCM's publisher, Linda Shapley.
It's really exciting, and it's something that is definitely a change in terms of how we approach our business. But, you know, it all kind of started, you know, the conversation definitely started last year, even before the Pueblo Press, where we were printing, where nearly like 36 papers were printing, announced that it was shutting down. I started at CCM in 2021, and to this point now, we spend about 38% more on printing than we did in 2021. And of course, you know, it becomes, you know, a giant cost. And so we want to make sure that, you know, we're spending our money in a way that can better help the journalism. And so what a printing press does is it allows us to hopefully control our own destiny a little bit better. I mean, obviously, we have to undergo a lot of the things that a number of the, you know, the printers who are here in this area have to do in terms of trying to find ways to, you know, economically get paper and ink and aluminum for plates and that sort of thing. But We have the opportunity now to kind of like, you know, hold in our costs and control our destiny a little bit more.
You said 38% increase in just a couple of years. What's driving that mm-hmm. increase?
You know, I mean, I think part of it is, you know, a number of printers, and these are things that, of course, you know, we're looking at too, is that the cost of labor were increasing. At the time, you know, we were going through a pretty considerable supply chain shortage. If you recall, like right after the pandemic, you know, a number of places, paper mills that used to create paper, because of the pandemic, they started switching from newsprint to creating cardboard boxes because everybody was ordering, you know, online from Amazon and all those kinds of things. So all of a sudden, there was a great giant demand for cardboard boxes. And so paper mills are like, well, this is where the demand is. So we're going to start making more cardboard boxes instead of newsprint, which then made newsprint harder to find, harder to obtain, more costly, and that sort of thing. And then you saw those prices just start to really continue to grow and spike. The cost of gas, we were printing, when I first started, we were printing in Cheyenne up at the Adams Publishing Group facility. And so, of course, you know, the gas to transport the papers down to us was a cost. And then we suffered, I should say, a similar cost when we went to Pueblo, because essentially that, you know, cost was for transportation was the other way. So, you know, those were definitely some of the costs that were involved. The labor, of course, that goes into a press is also another thing. You know, as costs have needed to rise in order to keep up with the cost of living in this area, and making sure that, you know, workers are paid a fair wage, those costs went up as well. And so I think that, you know, it was just this, you know, perfect storm of a number of different types of the supplies that are needed, all those costs starting to go up.
Some people listening to this might say, well, who is still reading the print version of a newspaper? So can you tell us about your readership and why print is still important?
You know, print media just really does continue to be a very crucial link in helping keep residents informed and connected with the places that they call home. You know, certainly, you know, we still have a very strong base of subscribers who prefer to consume their news in a printed format. And, you know, that's definitely true for some of our more remote communities. You know, certainly in the Denver area, there's no lack of news organizations that are, you know, providing their information, you know, digitally to help cover Denver and, you know, the kind of like Denver politics and the, you know, what's happening in the city government and that sort of thing. Where that gets to be a little bit more complicated is when you get to the suburbs. You know, Colorado Community Media has 9 papers in Douglas County, and I think we're the only one who have that. You know, we've got it in a number of places, in Lone Tree and Highlands Ranch and Castle Rock and that sort of thing. And, you know, those are publications where if we weren't there, there wouldn't be somebody who's covering them or paying attention to them on a regular basis. And, you know, our network is in 8 counties, and in a number of those counties or in a number of those communities, we're the only publisher there. We do have an online presence, and certainly we see that, you know, online is where we want to make sure that we're not dropping the ball in terms of our coverage. But it's always been my thought that you deliver the news in the platform that people want it. And if people can prefer to have their news in print and that they're dedicated to having their news in print, then I want to make sure that I'm delivering that in the best way possible in terms of, you know, controlling the expense around it, but still giving people the opportunity to do what they need to do.
About how many papers are you going to be printing at your new facility?
So we have 21 weekly papers, 2 monthlies, and then we also have 2 shoppers that we have, you know, which are essentially just advertising newspapers. That's just the technical term for them.
And what kind of numbers are we talking about amongst those 25 papers?
You know, our largest publication is the Arvada Press, which we distribute for free in Arvada. And that goes to a good number of people. I would say across the metro area, you know, our circulation is around 100,000. 8 of our papers are free and the rest are paid. And they, you know, are distributed around in 8 counties around the area.
Tell us about your nonprofit model and also the grant funding you received to acquire this new printing press.
That's one of the things that's really important about one of the things that we're trying to do is that, you know, we're owned by the National Trust for Local News, which is a nonprofit that's really, you know, dedicated into keeping newspapers, legacy news organizations resilient and, like, you know, trying to make sure that they're shoring up their business in the best ways possible. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, the National Trust for Local News has a real mission in terms of, like, making sure that they're helping these helping the ecosystem for news and local news strong. And so with that mission in mind, you know, as the decisions were coming forth in terms of, like, you know, perhaps trying to pursue purchasing a press is the way we want to go, we were lucky in terms of, like, trying to be able to reach out to the folks at the Colorado Media Project. And they played a really big part in terms of, like, just helping us connect us with other funders and seeing that the mission-driven nature of what we were trying to do, that we were trying to, you know, it's thinking in things in a way that, you know, leverages that economy of scale, that, you know, the more folks who are interested in kind of, like, you know, using that, you know, helping us with the community benefit, you know, make that community benefit argument that, you know, obviously this is a help to Colorado Community Media, but it's also a help to the, you know, the dozens of other papers that lost printing in Pueblo, you know, where we'd heard that some folks closed, some folks collapsed, or, you know, like, tightened up what they were printing and did other things in order to either absorb the cost of moving their printing to somewhere else, or, you know, finding somewhere else that they could, you know, or, you know, just trying to withstand I think we had 2 months when Pueblo closed. So, you know, the Colorado Media Project, I think, was a really important thing for us in terms of just trying to figure out, like, how we could, you know, do the research that, I mean, essentially Colorado Media Project helped bring in funders that, like, you know, do the research and figure out that the issue was widespread. They had done, you know, they had done a essentially kind of a printing study of, like, talking to a number of publishers throughout the state in order to say, you know, how bad is this problem for you? How difficult is it for you to print? You know, a lot of those kinds of surveys. And so they had kind of released a report. I want to say back a little bit more, but, you know, that mission-driven thing to, or, you know, that mission-driven focus to say that we want things to be affordable but sustainable is a real big part of what we were trying to do and what we want to continue to do once the printing press is up and running. One of the things that's really important for us is to know that, you know, in addition to the print thing, I mean, obviously, I mean, I think it's been described as a man bites a dog kind of situation, because so many news organizations are, you know, I think the term that it gets thrown around a lot is pivoting to digital. But, you know, we recognize that what we need is we just need runway in order to help us move toward that digital future. And we've done a lot in order to make sure that we are embracing, you know, what we can do for our digital future. And, you know, I mean, I think the surveys have said that, like, 60 to 70% of people get their news from either their phone or from their computer. And so it's not that we want to ignore those folks, but I think that it just is, it's incumbent on us to be loyal to the print readers and to respect you know, what the value is in terms of reading your news in print. It has less of that reactionary approach to how we are, to how we consume our news. It gives us an opportunity to think and be more thoughtful, and it just kind of pulls us out of that sometimes really doom scroll that you get from reading news online.
Linda Shapley is publisher of Colorado Community Media. They print about a couple dozen newspapers in different communities along the Front Range and Eastern Plains, and they got a new printing press. It's a nonprofit media organization. 25 minutes after 8 here at KGNU. Well, if you're looking to reduce stress in your life, and who isn't, Denise Barnes has some ideas for you. She's the author of Stress to Strength, A Therapist's Guide to Empower Clients. Denise is a licensed psychotherapist and life coach working here in Boulder. She joins us now in studio. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Sam.
So this is a book for therapists, but also for everybody?
Right. Especially if they've been to therapy, they'll be able to jump in. It's a pack of tools that build on each other. And but mainly for therapists to use with clients and for themselves. So I'm hoping it'll reduce burnout in the field.
What has worked for you personally and for you as a therapist? Like, give us a couple of really important tools.
Sure. So one big thing is to take stock of what you do to cope. So active coping versus passive. So active might be sitting down, problem solving, doing some meditation, exercising. Passive, doom scrolling, Netflix binging, right? So you can see one would be more effective. So for me personally, I have a morning practice where I'll do exercise, meditation, some journaling maybe, and just kind of keep present with myself, keep up to date with that. Another key piece is looking at problems in terms of what is in your control and what is not, right? We know the Serenity Prayer talks about that. So these tools, the system gives you a map to match the best coping with the controllability of the stressor. So it's more effective, and it up-levels your coping options, let's say.
So can you give us an example, like a specific stressor where you might say this is the tool to use?
Sure. So let's say you're worried about a job interview coming up. If you look at what you can control, that would be being prepared. Like for me with this interview, I prepare myself, right? And then if anxiety comes up, that's more about, you know, maybe not so related with taking action, then I can use tools for anxiety, right? So then I might look at why am I so stressed about this? Is there anything I can do to separate maybe past experience from current? And so that would be, those would be the emotion-focused coping tools versus problem-focused, which are more logical brain.
Mm-hmm. Like the preparation.
Right, the preparation. Yeah. You know, if you're doing an interview, looking over your resume and things like that. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, and what kinds of things have clients shared with you, obviously just generically, not any individuals, about what's working for them as far as stress management?
Well, you know, people can learn this pretty quickly. And those that have, that the system works for, they say, I don't feel like a big ball of stress anymore. You know, I have options. I've had, you know, people come in having panic attacks that then, you know, say, I've come a long way, right? So they just know they have tools to use. They have a way to sit down with it and do something effective. That's the part. Our first instinct is to avoid, right? Put off stress, put off tough talks, but then they increase the stress, or we increase by our own stressful reaction to the stress we're already having. So leaning towards it and taking effective action helps a lot.
Yeah, and it sounds like understanding, like, what kind of stress is this?
Exactly.
Yeah, I haven't thought of it in that way, so thank you for that. And you're going to be talking about it tomorrow night, 7 p.m. at the Remington Post condominium complex there off of 30th Street?
That's right. It's at the clubhouse, 3350 Chisholm Trail.
If people want more information, how can they connect with you if they, you know, about the event or about the book?
Sure. They can contact me, mdenisebarnes@gmail.com, and the website is soulsavvy.net, N-E-T.
And we'll have that on the Morning Magazine for today as well. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Sam. Great to be here.
Denise Barnes, the book is called Stress to Strength, A Therapist's Guide to Empower Clients. Again, she's talking about it tomorrow night at 7 at the Remington Post Complex in Boulder. More information available on the Morning Magazine for today at kgnu.org. Where it's 8:30 in the morning, time for news from the BBC, and then Jackie Sedley continues with the Eating Disorders series.
BBC News with David Harper. Palestinian medics say they're recovering dozens of bodies from what's left of Gaza's biggest hospital, Al-Shifa, after Israeli troops ended an intense two-week bombardment. The Gaza Health Ministry says the hospital is now completely out of service. The Kremlin has dismissed a report by Western news outlets that links Russian agents to the mystery illness Havana syndrome. The illness has affected US diplomats since 2016. The report alleges that the Americans were targeted by Russian operatives using directed energy weapons. A Russian court has extended the pretrial detention of a journalist with US citizenship by another 2 months. Alsu Komarsheva was charged last year with failing to self-register as a foreign agent and for spreading false information about Moscow's armed forces. Her employer, Radio Free Europe, has called the allegations baseless. Officials in Russia say that 4 men detained in Dagestan on Sunday helped fund last month's deadly attack on a concert hall in Moscow. The suspects were arrested on suspicion of terrorist offences. Fast food workers in the US state of California have had a pay rise as minimum wage has been increased to $20 an hour. The average increase of 25% affects about 500,000 employees at chains including McDonald's and Pizza Hut. India's weather office says the country will experience more extreme heat than normal between April and June. Temperatures crossed 40 Celsius in many parts of the country last year. Some